please, you know, don't y'all can't be like the U.S. military with your roots and your divinations and all that. You can't. It's collateral damage out here. You can't do that. So whoever put in the roots, whoever, you know, has offended the head rap army, you know, it ain't me. I don't know why I'm coming in. It's snowing when I got to get my garden delivery. Why? You know, I come in here and it smells like sage. I've never come in here and it smelled like somebody been burning sage in the studio. I get here late for the first time. I've never short started my show so late. So whoever putting these roots down, you know, if King Dita, because he's like I said, I don't start mess with sisters in long skirts past their ankles and head wraps that are at least, you know, 2.5 feet. So I'm going to get to the show. I'm just, you know, I don't want to have to get into that conflict of the nether realms. Get the roots off me. I ain't done nothing to provoke roots. I have not crossed any of you black magic, black girl magic women. So, you know, let's say, so let's have a good week. It's not off to the best start, but hey, whatever. I'm just going to trump this, you know, if it's unprofessional, if it ain't what it's supposed to be, man, if y'all let a man who don't know what he's doing run the country, then, you know, y'all can't be too tough on me about this. And plus, I got roots on me. At least I think I do. I was told that if you don't believe in roots, then they can't affect you. So I'm going to start to, I somehow suspended my disbelief, so I have to reenact my disbelief. Anyway, that's not even what I want to talk about. I mean, it seems like I've just come on. I spent Wednesday and Friday talking about effeminization and homosexuality and the LGBTQAI movement and the African liberation struggle and talking about LGBTQAI in context of the black liberation struggle. And I didn't really intend to dedicate that much showtime to the issue. But like I said, you know, dudes have been challenging me to fights in the streets. Dudes have been, I've even gotten the threat of a Second Amendment remedy, to quote Sarah Palin. Someone wanted to issue a Second Amendment remedy. And I felt like it was blown out of context. And like I said, whenever, you know, the people who oppress us, the systems and institution of global white domination, every time they decide they want to get into a fight, we always feel like we have to pick sides. And, you know, right now it's the immigration struggle. And black folks are lining up on one side, get them out, they took our jobs, and on the other side, let them in. And, you know, when white folks decide, okay, we spent from our founding, our puritanical founding, where we were burning witches and tar and feathering homosexuals, and they had us on the plantation and set us down on Sundays and told us, you know, Leviticus, obey thy master and hate the gays because they're clean and undirty. So we said, very well, you know, obey our masters, love Jesus Christ and persecute the gays. And then all of a sudden, the same people who spent centuries teaching us to persecute the gays, who wrote laws to persecute the gays, then all of a sudden say, okay, stop persecuting the gays. And some of us were like, okay, we will follow your new rules. And many of us were like, well, no, we want to stick to the old rules that master gave us. So we have these, you know, white, black nationalist militant, anti-white, supposedly black militants who are adopting the old puritanical standards. And then we have black liberals who are embracing the new spirit of the age, the new liberalism of the age. But nobody has really taken a moment to step back and say, what does it mean according to black interests, the black liberation struggle? Now, there are some liberals and progressives who say, well, you know, it is part and parcel of our struggle. It is central to our struggle. Black Lives Matter says that gay liberation is central to our struggle. And then I look down the historical record and I saw many gay, lesbian, transgender, queer, non-gender conforming people from, I mean, J. Edgar Hoover was a homosexual man who, you know, they say that cross-dressed and all that. And he took down everybody from Garvey to King to Malcolm X. So I have to say to Black Lives Matter, obviously, you know, liberalizing the world and making the world safe for LGBTQAI does not automatically translate into any level of liberation for black folks, not even black LGBTQAI, because at the height of the gay rights movement, black trans women and men are under siege, you know, with targeted killings and assaults. And the larger movement has done nothing. There are higher rates of suicide, homelessness, poverty, incarceration, you know, denial of health care and treatment for black, trans, LGBTQAI, and the larger gay rights struggle has not spoke to these issues or taken any real targeted action against these issues. Even when you go back to the 80s and 90s with the gay men's health crisis and the other ACT UP and these other white gay rights and gay empowerment movements, they left black folks in the dust and continue to do it. And as they went about to get the so-called HIV infection rates down in the white community, they begin to balloon in the white. So even when you say, oh, gay rights, giving rights to gays will translate, doesn't even translate into benefits for the black gay community, let alone for the larger gay community. So everybody on each side of the conflict is lying, just like most conflicts. And all my appeal was that we sit down and we do a diagnosis of our own community and we determine what's best for our own community. Instead of, like I said, every time white folks decide they want a reform, they want a movement, they want a revelation, they want a renaissance, we always feel like we have to pick sides on our oppressors' issues instead of determining and pushing forward our own issues according to our own interests. And I think that it comes to the point now that if we've got African people who cannot, for the life of them, define an issue outside of what the dominant system is doing, if they feel like if the satellites and the cameras aren't aimed at them, if they're not on CNN or having their leaders interviewed by Fox News, then what's the point? We have to just let them go and stop allowing them to drag the rest of us into those movements. You know, white folks was like, we want to have a communism versus capitalism fight. And they're all black folks in the streets beating each other in the head over who's a capitalist and who's a communist. You know, and it's totally insane. Thank goodness, you know, we weren't around for the Protestant versus Catholic fight. But now we're even doing that. We're even having that out. We're even fighting all religious conflicts that we were exempt from. We've gone and dug up old white conflicts that white folks ain't even fighting no more. On the African continent, in our country, we still fighting over Western religious dogma. You know, we still digging up the Council of Nice. and you know, we still having to fight, you know, the Crusades, Islam versus Christianity and all. I mean, we fighting old white folks fights that white folks ain't even fighting anymore. While our issues, our agenda go unadvanced, unconstructed, while our young people die in the streets, while our elders go unattended to, you know, while the agendas that directly aimed at us, the exploitation, resource rape that comes at us goes totally unchallenged because we busy over fighting over, you know, whether or not, you know, God is here to condemn gays or you know, liberalism is the way. We fighting over fights. And every single time when you look at all these struggles, capitalism versus communism, the labor movement, and soon to be as even the gay rights movement starts to wrap up. When we look at all that, we go into this under oppression and we come out the other side under oppression. Every single major Western uprising, every single, even look at the progressive era. You know, go back and look at the labor rights movement, which is a very significant movement. Go all the way back to Crispus Attucks. I think we're coming up on the anniversary of that fool. And the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. We go into this stuff and we come out the other sides of these movements just in the same socioeconomic, political positions that we went into the movement in. Even the Civil Rights Movement, we went into that movement poor. We came out that other side of that movement poor. Even the Civil Rights Movement. And the only people that got anything from the Civil Rights Movement was the upper classes. The Bill Cosbys. The Oprah Winfreys. The Jay-Z's and Beyonce. But you take the average black person of lower middle class, impoverished, and even middle class. You take the average black person, and they don't experience much change on a day-to-day, face-to-face level. The cops are just as disrespectful and act with just as much impunity. And now they can't say nigger, but they can say thug. They can say welfare. They can say urban. So they just got a new way to say nigger. They treat us the same, and they got a different thing. And then, we can sit on anywhere on the bus we want to sit. But then, who was it that said, because there was no economic platform in the civil rights movement, we the only people on the damn bus. We the only people on the damn bus. And even before the civil rights movement got started, the deurbanization of white folks were moving out to the suburbs and left us in the cities alone. So it wasn't no white folks around to even for us to sit in front of. We had to sit behind them, and then they moved. So we was like, yo. So wasn't no white people left on the bus. So even in our own damn movements, we don't even do it right. We still doing it by their standards. And we did get some affirmative action. We did get more black people in school. You know what the civil rights movement gave us? Clarence Thomas. He's a civil rights baby. He's an affirmative action baby. If not for the civil rights movement, we would not have had Clarence Thomas, Condoleezza Rice. We wouldn't have had Condoleezza Rice without civil rights, without the civil rights movement. Dr. King got shot in the neck for Condoleezza Rice. Malcolm X took slugs to the chest for Clarence Thomas, because these are the primary benefactors. You could say they was fighting for us, but, you know, I could claim I'm out here fighting for my children, but if everything I gain goes to somebody else, then that's who benefited. So intentions are not. I know that's not why they died. I know that's not what they were fighting for, but that's how it played out. So we got to be smarter in the movements. We got to be smarter in how we approach these movements. We got to be smarter in how we execute these movements. And we got to be smarter that when we can fight our oppressors, when we can fight the system and gain concessions from the system, we have to stop allowing them to say, okay, the people in the streets fighting for us to give up some concessions, for us to make some deals, big deals, for us to give up some resources to fund some programs. And then we allow the people we fought to handpick who they want to both administer the program and benefit from the program. So all these Uncle Toms that sat on the sidelines, all these fake militants that sat on the sidelines, when it comes time to get the concessions, it's given over to them, and then it's dispersed between them. You know, even when the campus movement, when black folks rose up on the campuses, and the college it paralleled the civil rights struggle, and they got Africana studies departments, and they got black professors hired, and a lot of them black professors been there since the 70s. They ain't hired no new black people. And those black professors, those black academics sat in the ivory towers and studied our decline. We thought the whole point we were sending black folks into academia is for them to get the intelligence, the skills, make the connections, to develop the insights that they needed in order to empower us, to engage in statecraft, to secure control of resources and how to refine process and equally distribute those resources. And all they did was like, huh, look at how those niggas is suffering. Drug addiction, single parenthood, teenage pregnancy, huh, homicides, incarceration. And they wrote all these wonderful papers studying how we was getting jacked up in the streets. That wasn't the purpose of our academics. You were supposed to go up and fight against and obstruct. You're supposed to look and say, huh, look at the agenda of the government. This particular agenda, this particular policy, this particular platform, this particular political party is acting against the interests of my people. But thankfully, my people marched in the street so I can get into these ivory towers, so I can study these systems and institutions and techniques and programs. And then I can go to my people and say, here's a detailed method on how to counteract this measure, on how to reverse this measure. And here are some specific actions we take to sanction our enemies, to discourage them from enacting any more further policies against our interests. That's what we sent y'all to do in the halls of academia. But all y'all could do is just tell us how much we suffering as if we didn't know. Even Michelle Alexander, take nothing away from her in what's the book? The New Jim Crow. She wrote a book telling us how much we're suffering. And everybody's like, whoa, wow, this is a... Even in that book, she was like, the poor niggas already knew this. I was late. I was went to law school. And after I got out of law school and I was doing legal aid work in Oakland on the West Coast, I was doing all this liberal stuff. And I would see flyers from the poor blacks, the blacks on the streets, the blacks who don't have law degrees, who ain't been to the colleges and universities, who don't have passports with multiple stamps, just the poor, round-the-way lumping proletariat, black lumping. They were putting up flyers saying this is a genocide against black people. And she said, puff, pshaw, they don't understand the laws. They don't understand policy. Black people are going to jail because they didn't obey the law. That's all. It's no conspiracy. And then she wrote this book. And then other middle-class black folks who were exempt from some of the biggest ravages of the systems and institutions of white supremacy because you serve the systems and institutions. You are an asset to our oppressors. Not to your people. You're an asset to our oppressor. So y'all finally got this book. Y'all middle-class uppity black folks are like, wow, there's a whole new Jim Crow against us. And now y'all starting to feel the pain because, look, it eventually gets up. Even in Nazi Germany, them wealthy Jews in diamonds and fur coats who ate on, you know, crystal and silver cookware and plates and wine glasses, they swore up and down if those Jews would just stop committing crimes, stop being thugs, if they just learned to speak proper German, and they dress like proper German. If those Orthodox Jews would just stop dressing and self-segregating themselves and integrated into society, then the Reich, you know, then these jackboot thugs, then you wouldn't get shot. You know? But then eventually that knock came to the door. I mean, one of the best movies that betrayed us, because there's so many... You know, anytime you want an Oscar, make a Holocaust movie, of course. But there's one, you know, Schindler's List. That was one of the few movies that really show how the elite Jews really thought they were exempt. And they were just running. And because where were the bad Jews? The bad Jews were in the ghetto. That's where the word come from. Ghetto ain't a black word. That's a European word. Slum, ghettos. Those are, you know, white folks. Those are the black folks. There's no black constructed slum or ghetto. Every ghetto that black folks occupy was constructed and set up and pre-planned by white people. Even the favelas in Brazil, black people didn't create that. We think, because we like to think just because we occupy a space, then we must have made that space. You know, my kids have little rodents, little gerbils with tunnels and stuff. They occupy that, but that don't make it theirs. They didn't make it. They just occupy the space. But anyway, the Schindler's List movie shows Jews, when the Nazis came, when that knock came at the door, they were gathering up gold. They were trying to take down fine works of art, putting on like three or four layers of fur coat and fine silks to try to take, and got all these, the dude was like sticking gold bars into his wife's duffel bags. And they had them gather up all this stuff. And then they marched the wealthy elite Jews. And this is in Krakow in Poland. This wasn't even in Germany. Marched them to the train. And you had the poor people standing on side to side, looking dirty, poor people. And I'm really surprised that I think it was Spielberg showed this. But anyway, the when they got to the train, they were like, ha ha, you thought we was going to let you keep this. And then they had them strip everything, take the gold, everything. But they just let them have that little bit, last bit of hope. Have that last bit of hope. And so that's what's happening right now. You know, Bill Cosby was telling us that white people kept their side of the bargain. The white folks had figured out that they were doing wrong by us in the 60s and decided to stop doing wrong by us and said, okay, we're going to give you rights. We're going to give you opportunities. We're going to set aside programs and funds, and we're going to, here you go, black folks, everything you could ever ask for. And that was their end of the bargain. Stop oppressing us and give us resources to rebuild. That was their end of the bargain. And so our end of the bargain was to, I don't know, stop being niggas. I don't know what Bill Cosby, he didn't give any specifics on our side, but he said that black people, we didn't keep up our end of the bargain. And so I guess Bill Cosby believed in the 70s they had this program called benign neglect. And the benign neglect program essentially stated that the society has given too much attention to this race thing. It's occupied too much of our time. We're in the middle. We got to go fight this Cold War. You know, we got to go. And this is when they started the whole, we're trying to industrialize China and Vietnam and these other places so we can go set up U.S. industry in foreign land and take advantage of starvation wages and the absent environmental policies. So they said, this black issue, enough. We've really been dealing with this black issue since the era of Reconstruction. We've had uprisings. We had the Red Summer of 1919, race riots all over the country. We had all these characters from Marcus Garvey all the way down to Huey P. Newton. I had all these characters pop up, and America was like, enough. I'm sick of the race issue. I'm sick of it. I've given all my time. I've given all these resources, and the race issue has taken up too much time in America. So they said it would benefit from benign neglect. And benign means non-harmful, non-active. So like if you have a benign tumor, it's not spreading. It's not metastasizing. And neglect means we're just basically going to ignore this thing. And black folks, you know, we get so upset about color blindness, but that's basically what the United States decided to do on a political level. Benign neglect. We're not going to have any race-specific policies. We're not going to have any anti-black or pro-black anything. We're not going to be anti or pro-black. We're just going to ignore this thing because there's bigger fish to fry. Right? And so during that era of benign neglect, Bill Cosby said, we decided we wanted to dance and have babies out of wedlock and cuss. We really like cussing. You know, it's a real big thing with black folks. We really, really, really want to cuss. Immoral sex. Basically all the things white people used to say about us. And we didn't keep up our end of the bargain. The white man showed up at our doorstep with all this resources, all these new opportunities, all this favoritism. And he dropped it at our doorstep, and then he went away and started doing benign neglect. He's like, it's all yours. Everything you could ever ask for. Here it is at your doorstep. And good day to you, sir. And then the white man returns after 20, 30 years, and we done smoked it, spent it all on, I don't know, expensive sneakers and hair weaves and fingernails. And we gotten high, and, you know, when he came to the doorstep, there was just a few hundred of us, and then we just bred like rabbits irresponsibly. And now we didn't keep up our end of the bar. So here the white man is, again, burdened by us black, all these black people. Now, again, I have to rescue these black people from themselves. And not only do I have to, at the same time I'm trying to rescue these immoral, incompetent black people from themselves, at that exact same time, I have to also insulate the larger society from their corrupting influences. Now this is what they really think, and this is what Bill Cosby and Oprah Winfrey and Thomas Stowell, Black Sky, it wasn't just the entertainers, there were many scholars who made millions of dollars. If we rose to global prominence, like people like Thomas Stowell, we don't know of them in the hood because they are so absurd. But white folks, they know these dudes. When they think of a good black, these, you know, you think Clarence Thomas and Condoleezza Rice are the only black folks selling us? No, there's thousands of them that we fought to get them in school. We fought to get these Negroes affirmative action, and they out here Thomasing and Condoleezing. You know, yeah, Uncle Tom's. And so anyway, here they are again trying to rescue us from ourselves. Now, this is the myth, and it doesn't hold up to any cursory examination. Now, I'm not even going to go into deconstructing the myth, because if you believe in that, you're probably not listening to the show. But this is what we fall for. So my thing is, we got a lot of work to do. We have limited resources and even less time than resources to have it. And we have very few people within our community that have the interest of doing this work. And the people who have the interest of doing the liberation work within that minority, there's only a smaller minority of people who are rational enough to do the work. Because even if you isolate for all the black integrationists, the black self-haters, the black people who believe, the Cosbys. Now, Cosby, of course, has been disgraced. But his ideology, his damage was done. And now, I know Cosby was recreated, turned into a martyr. And a lot of these so-called conscious black people want to talk about how Cosby's the victim of some vast conspiracy, when the reality is Cosby was the proponent of a vast conspiracy. Cosby is not a victim of an anti-black conspiracy. Cosby was the perpetrator and supporter and advocate and figurehead of an anti-black conspiracy. So when he reached his expiration date, when the white man picked him up, turned him over and looked at his ass and was like, oh, this nigger is past date, past due. I have no more use for him. Tossed him in the ash can of history. When he got his comeuppance, we stood up and defended this scumbag. You know, I wish, and I, you know, I should go play some of that Cosnerati, Bill Cosby's positive rap group. Just look it up. I ain't gonna, I can't subject myself. But Cosby even started a rap group called the Cosnerati to tell black folks what was wrong with us and how to get it together. How to stop burdening the white man with our problems. Oh my gosh. Anyway, yeah, that it just, it really frustrated me that we pretended that. And my thing is this, if you come under attack by the system, and before somebody can call you, because they attack us, they like to, this thing, it thrill kill. They'll just bring you down for the fun of it, just to see if they can do it. And as far as it breaking black folks' morale and discouraging us and the community disruption, that's just bonus. They just do it. They just go kill a giant lion for no reason, just to kill something big and magnificent. So I have no doubt that the system is fully capable of targeting Bill Cosby for giggles. But I know damn well ain't nobody in any system or any position of power, it's not rational for them to target Bill Cosby as a threat to the status quo. Because there was no greater cheerleader for the white status quo than Bill Cosby. So come on now. But that's what we fought for. And all that's my point saying. Back to the breakdown. Within the conscious community, within the revolutionary community, the cultural community, all these black people who embrace not just their blackness, but embrace the mission to make a positive contribution to the just aspiration of black people. And I don't care if you're fighting for civil rights, if you're fighting for homelessness, if you're fighting for mothers, African mothers and children, if you're fighting on an international level, or you're fighting on a block-to-block, hood-to-hood level. All the black people that qualify as that, as opposed to the apolitical black people, the deliberate conscious sellouts, or the indifferent neutral black folks who just doing them. I'm doing me. The only color I see is green. Them cats, that don't even count. That don't want no parts of the movement or nothing like that. You know, and they've been here since Harriet Tubman's day. Black folks who ain't trying to do nothing but get by, you know, on crumbs like cockroaches. Those people have always been. But just inside our movement, the vast majority of those people are not rational enough. They're not critical thinkers. So in their mission to do something positive for our people, they come up with some of the most absurd, backwards, dysfunctional stuff you could think of. But I know some of their hearts are in the right place. I know their desires to better us, but they can't even really understand what betterment is. You know, if you're sick and you see somebody that's like, I'm so sad that you're sick. It makes me hurt. And I wish there's something I could do for you. They could mean that. But are you going to hand them a scalpel? Is the desire to do good enough to give them the skills to do good? Are you going to just find somebody who's like, oh, I have appendicitis. Let me just find anybody that wants me to feel better. Oh, I have a desire. I feel bad that you're sick and I want you to feel better. Well, that's enough. That qualifies you to do surgery. Take this scalpel and get busy because you desire to do good. I'm telling you, love of my people. I love my people. I'm proud to be black. All that's well and good. Don't take nothing away from that. But that don't qualify you to engage in revolutionary struggle. I'm sorry. Not on a competent level. Now, I would prefer to have a physician that has an innate desire to do good, that cares, that genuinely cares about the health and well-being, because I did. when I was working as a radiographer, when I was working as a clinical instructor, I had a deep-seated desire to see people be healthy. And I would do not only the job they paid me for, but if there was something I could do above and beyond that, I would do it. Because I really, really wanted people to be healthy. But on top of that, I had the skills, training, certification, and competence to do what I desire to do. It wasn't just a desire. It wasn't just a motivation. But in the struggle, you'll find that a lot of our people, they just have the desire. They just have the motivation. But when you sit and try to talk to them and say, let's understand what the problem is, you'll find that they will say to you, it's these single mothers out here, oh, that's the problem. Black people are our own worst enemy. We need to put the black man back in charge of the family. We need to get this money, huh? We need to get money. Now, there's a lot, like I say, if somebody, again, you've got a person with a strong desire but no skills, they will look at you and say, you look sick, man. Oh, I've seen that before. I think you got like appendicitis. Oh, I feel so bad for you. I wish there was something I could do. So even if they're able to identify some of the problems, that doesn't mean that they understand the totality of the problem. And even if they understand the totality of the problem, that does not mean that they have the skills to enact a cure or to carry out or prescribe the proper medicine. And so we have a lot of black folks that are really motivated. But here's the thing that I have to say to you conscious black people, because you sit and talk to the same conscious black people. If you want to be to be a novelist, you don't just say the desire is enough. You know doggone well you got to go learn how to write the English language, how to interpret and read the English language. You got to learn certain literary techniques, and you have to go and study novelists of the past. I don't care if it's Mark Twain or Toni Morrison. You've got to read other great writers. And anyone who doesn't do that, you could still write. I'm sure you could put some words to paper. It was a dark and cold night, and it was not warm at all because, like I said, it was cold. But it's not going to be great. I mean, there's certain things you just have to do. Like if you want to be a fighter, forget a novelist. You want to be a boxer. Just the desire, you jump in that ring with somebody who's trained. And I know we sometimes do have the white man's education, white man's standard, white man this. You know, we like to call things the white man, especially stuff we don't want to do. I know I've done it myself. My wife said to me, oh, you want me to take out the white man's trash? Huh? You know, so if it's something we don't want to do, especially in the conscious community, I don't know what Negro, I've been in the conscious community. I don't really know what baseline black folks do, what you know, the black folks who eat pork and pray to Jesus. Like I don't know. I know black folks, but I ain't really with y'all like that. I don't be around you. When I'm around black, I'm around like cultural and conscious and African-centered black people. So I know how we do. I don't know what y'all do, but we like to, if it's something we don't like or something we don't want to do, we like to call it the white man, you know. So you come up and be like, oh, I'm agnostic. I'm an atheist. Atheism is a white man. And then I'll look and be like, oh, you're a Christian or a Muslim. Muslim is the white man. So we call things the white man we don't necessarily want to do. But let's be realistic. I set that aside. It's just us talking. We're in a safe black space. Right? There's certain prerequisites you need. And when you talk all that white man this, white man that, when your little baby girl get appendicitis, let's be realistic. You're not going to the herbalist. And not only are you not going to the herbalist, you're going to want to make sure that individual has certifications and qualifications and a certain level of practice and competency, and that there's an oversight. There's a level of oversight on that individual. People watching them, making sure they stay up on it, making sure they keep up on their continuing education. You're going to want some type of structure and apparatus there to guarantee that your loved one is getting the proper care. Oh, forget it. It ain't got to be life and death. You want that for your mechanic. And guess what? If you go back to Africa, any part of Africa, you'll see that training, education. Now, there weren't necessarily certifications in the Western sense. But like Amos Wilson, in his research, he said it took about 40 years to train a scholar in Africa. The priesthood, you know, and the priest, again, the priesthood, that was the university system, you know, where you would, whether you wanted to be a physician, a scribe, a mason, or architect, whatever, astrologist, whatever you wanted to do, it took decades, even in an African context, whether it was a mentorship, whether it was an apprenticeship, whether it was some type of initiation into a society. It took decades to get up there. So this whole, you know, being tested, tried and true, is not something that is alien to our ancestors, and nothing that's alien to us. So please, and even Dr. Clark, an historian, what he say? I had to go sit at the foot of Schomburg. You know, and he even had to go to white scholars like Gerald Massey, and referred to Albert Churchward. So he even went to white scholars and historians and anthropologists to learn his techniques for scholarship and to reference some of their work and research. So let's be realistic. But you'll find that if you got a young brother in the hood that says, I want to be a doctor, he goes through years of training and research. And even when he secures his degree, he goes into fellowships or residency, and he's constantly having to hone and refine his skills. And then his colleagues are always, you know, a mutual form of support and to help test him. If a dude wants to be a baller, shot caller, 40-inch rims on his Impala, if a dude wants to be a professional basketball player, same thing. He's going to be out there dribbling and chasing balls day and night, every opportunity, doing weight training, fitness training, you know, going to take time to preserve his joints, take the proper supplements, whatever. But if a dude says, I want to be a revolutionary, all you got to do is get a big wooden onk and bada, instant revolutionary, instant qualified to go out and fight on the front lines of our struggle. And I'm telling you, from academia to sports and entertainment, sports is entertainment. So from academia to entertainment, the work of the liberation of African people is the most important work, and it requires the least amount of qualifications. We don't respect our struggle like we supposed to. And we really, really need to check that. And I say this because I'm constantly engaging in this discussion with people who are supposed to be my allies. People who are supposed to stand in common cause with me, even if we have a different method or a different, you know, path, we're supposed to have the same trajectory and ultimate goal, the liberation of our people. Right? But I sit and talk to these people and they sound as irrational as your average Christian. The Lord will make a way somehow, while here beneath the cross I bow. But they're like, liberation will come one day as long as I just keep spewing this absurd rhetoric and follow these various demagogues and watch enough YouTube videos. This is a science. You can call it political science. You can call it a policy initiative. You can call it what you want, but this is a systematic process. This is a multi-generational process. There is a wealth of history and method and practices that came before us to inform what we're doing now. But those ancient methods, history, whether you go back last week or 1,000 years to on the path to liberation and empowerment and statecraft, you can't just take it whole cloth. Somebody just came to me the other day, a brother I've been working with. We opened a bookstore. We started the African Race, and the African Race stood for Research and Application Collective in Brooklyn, New York. And basically what there were several study groups all over New York City. The premier study group, weekly study group, was Professor William Mackey's to the three. And it started at Mega Evers College, and Mega Evers kind of pushed him out. So he started that study group in his own basement. And believe you me, I've never seen a better library with my own eyes. And Professor Mackey. So there were study groups everywhere. But there was a small group of us who would go to these various study groups of these various scholars and researchers. And we decided, how do we apply what we learn? Every week we're getting new insights. We're getting some of the best education for free. Better than any type of African-centered political science, historical, or even technical instruction than you can get anywhere else. And so we's like, we want to apply it. So we want to research and apply. We want to take these lessons and these teachings and create programs and initiatives. We want physical brick-and-mortar infrastructure that is based on this intellectual insights. So we started the Research and Application Collective. Or RACE was an acronym. We broke it down. It was the African Research Application. But the brother I work with on that, and I've been you know, in him since way back when. You know, he later secured his law degree. And but we don't see eye to eye on a lot of things. But again, I'm proud to say I know a lot of people that I've worked with and have long-standing relationships with that I don't see eye to eye on. It kind of scares me, the people that move in these circles and everybody they talk to, yep. You ever see, I think it was Sesame Street, they had those funny aliens with the flip mouths and all, they go, yep. And I see dudes that roll together, you know, like these Hebrew Israelite cats that come to different meetings and gatherings in the hood, and everybody that they interact with on a regular basis is like, yep. They agree on everything absolutely all the time. That's a very weak, very, very weak. That's the kind, that's why Trump is so much less effective than Obama at imperialism. That's what Obama, Trump has a bunch of yes men, sycophants around him. That's not healthy. But anyway, dude just asked me the other day, I had made a statement, I don't even remember what I said. Oh, something about mixed race people. And my thing is, black people are black people, you know, and but I won't even pick at that wound. You know, I won't pick at that scab because it will bleed again. But basically, apparently I was asserting a position that the scholar, Chancellor Williams, had a different position on this one particular issue. Now, if you read Chancellor Williams' Deconstruction of Black Civilization, this is a book that spans almost 2,000 years of history. This brother literally spent his own personal fortune and literally went blind doing the research. That's how much work went into this. He traveled the world. This was firsthand primary source research there, right? And then in the destruction and reconstruction of African civilization. So there's a lot of content there. He's dealing with everything. From politics to spirituality and religion to ancient antiquity to modern conflicts. He's dealing with so much. But it's apparently some point in that book, I had said something that this individual interpreted and said, well, Chancellor Williams said something other than what you said on this particular issue. So the dude come at me like, oh, so you don't agree with Chancellor Williams. I'm like, dude, I'm the one that introduced you to Chancellor Williams. I'm the one that told you about the books. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Instead of saying, like, well, on this particular issue, or your particular conclusion on this particular issue is Chancellor Williams has taken a contrary position or advocated something different, you know, because I can't think of one scholar. Maybe Bobby Wright. If I had to pick Dr. Bobby Wright, maybe that everything I've read from them, every recording, every lecture, every article, like, wow, I agree with all this 100%. If there's anybody. You know, that's Christian talk. That's Jesus Christ. The Bible is God's, you know, pure word of God. That's not revolution. That's not conscious talk. And be like, well, you're wrong because Chancellor Williams doesn't agree with you. And not only that, Chancellor Williams was writing over 3 decades ago. You don't think there's any new information that Chancellor Williams, he's passed on. But if he was alive and working today, you think all of his positions would be identical? When we know our greatest revolution, the prince of the true prince of Pan-Africanism, Malcolm X, we see his evolution and his change in positions. And I don't mean from being a dope dealer, pimp thug to being a revolutionary, but even after he became conscious, he was still evolving. But this is the kind of mess I would think that at least in our struggle, we'd evolve beyond that. But nope, we still have a lot of contaminations from our less conscious days. Anyway, you listen to Q4 Radio, Bro Diallo Show, live and direct. Again, I have to apologize for the late start. And I have to apologize for not even taking responsibility for it. Yeah, you know, I'll take it. Even though in my heart, I believe my co-host, King Dita, brought roots down on us. Because everything we're dealing with, the show and Green, all the stuff we're doing, just things ain't lining up. I mean, it's going, I guess. We way up, we blessed. But, you know, it's just funny. Chicago ain't had snow in 3 months. And the day our gardening supplies are to be delivered for the program. And the week, this Wednesday, we start our Green Teens. We're going to have the young people on deck doing gardening. It's a big part of the Green Teens program, producing food, organic, non-GMO food. And on that week we start, it's a heavy snowstorm. So, King Dita, you better get on the phone to that sister that you was talking slick to, that you was bickering with, questioning her magic, questioning her powers and the power of her ancestors, and her connection to the oneness of the universe. You better get on deck and issue your apologies, man. Who knows? You know, by the time we got to get, we supposed to be building a greenhouse this week, and we're going to be putting together a greenhouse in 2 feet of snow. Because you can't humble yourself. Told you. If you're going to argue with a sister, first check. See if she got on a head wrap. But anyway, I'll get off of that. Let's take our musical break. And then I'll come back. Because I still want to deal with this issue of us not taking our struggle seriously enough. And us just trying to graft on to whatever is hot in the streets with our oppressor. This is Bro Diallo Show, AM 1680, Chicago.
You know them stakes is high when you talking about focal point bringing damage to your burrow. Be some brothers from the east with the beats that be thorough. Got the solar gravitation, so I'm bound to pull it. I gets down like brothers are found, ducking from bullets. Gun control means using both hands in my land. Yeah. It's all about the cautious living. Migrating to a higher form of consequence. Compliments. I'm struggling, that shouldn't be notable. Man, every word I say should be a hip hop quote.
I'm sick of bitches shaking asses. I'm sick of talking about blood. Sick of Versace glasses. Sick of slang. Sick of half ass award shows. Sick of name brand clothes. Sick of R&B bitches over bullshit trash. Cocaine and crap, which brings sickness to black. Sick of swole head rappers with they sickening raps. Claps and gaps, making a whole sick world collapse. The facts are getting sicker, even sicker perhaps. I'm sticking push to make a bundle to escape the synapse.
Man, life can get all up in your ass, baby. You better work it out. Now let me tell you what it's all about. My skin not considered equal. A meteor has more right than my people who be wasting time screaming who they've hated. That's why the native tongues has officially been reinstated. You know them stakes is high when we talking about stakes is high. Y'all know them stakes is high when we dealing with them. Stakes is high. Man, yo, stakes is high.
What about that love?
Yo, it's about love of cars, love of funds, loving to love mad sex, loving to love guns, love for opposite, love for fame and wealth, love for the fact of no longer loving yourself, kid. We living in them days of the man-made ways where every aspect is vivid. Word. These brothers no longer talk shit, hey, yo. These niggas living, about to give it to you 24/7 on the microphone. Plug one, translating the zone. No offense to a player, but yo, I don't play. And if you take offense, fuck it, got to be that way. JD Dub, show your love, what you got to say?
I say, please make your niggas out of high regard. And niggas dying for it nowadays ain't hard. Investing in fantasies and not God. Welcome to reality, see time is hard. People try to snatch the credit but can't claim the card. Showing out in videos saying they co-starred. See shit like that'll make your mama cry. Better watch the way you spend it cause the stakes is high.
You know them stakes is high when you're dealing with them.
is high. Check it. I think that smiling in public is against the law. What? Cause love don't get you through life no more. It's who you know and how you, son. And how you getting in and who the man holding he up. And how was the skins and how high? Yo, what up, high? I heard you caught a body. Seem like every man and woman shared a life with John Gotti.
But they ain't organized.
Mixing crimes with life enzymes. Taking the big scout route and niggas no doubt. Better than they know they daughters and they sons.
Oh, wow. Yo, people go through pain and still don't gain positive contact. Just like my main man who got others cleaning up his physical influence. His mind got congested, he got the non-influent. Neighborhoods are now hoods, cause nobody's neighbors, just animals surviving with that animal behavior under eye. We'll be rhyming from dark to light sky. Experiment with needles and skin connect. No wonder where we live is called the projects. When the mistakes is high, you damn sure try to do anything to get the piece of the pie. Electrify, even die for the cash, but at last you be out, even though you're wanting more. This issue was closed like an elevator door, but soon we open once we get to the next floor. Stakes is high, you know them stakes is high, and we're dealing with the
Chica, ooh, the dong, 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 the
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause I'm high and cholesterol.
Come on, come on.
And don't fight, do you eat them? No tip, do you eat them? Not at all.
Oh, yeah.
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause I'm high and cholesterol. You're obese, do you eat them?
Nope, shot, do you eat them?
Nope, not at all.
Hey.
A casket, what's a mama's basket? Some veggie links
and some fish that stinks.
Why just the other day I went to grandma's house.
Smelled like you conjured up a mouse.
Eggs was frying,
ham was smelling.
In 10 minutes, she started yelling,
come and get it!
And the gettings were good. I said I shouldn't eat it, she said I think you should.
But I can't, I'm plagued by vegetarians.
No cats and dogs, I'm not a veterinarian.
Strictly collard greens and an occasional steak.
Was on my plate, asparagus tips look yummy, yummy, yummy.
Candy M's inside my tummy.
A collage of good eats, a snack, some nice treats.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
This is what we snacked on when requested.
No second guessing. I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause I'm high in cholesterol.
I dig it, dig it, dig it,
do you eat them? No tip, do you eat them? Not at all.
Come on again.
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause I'm high in cholesterol.
Zero
beat, yeah.
No shot, do you eat them?
Nope, not at all.
Bridge.
I dropped the beat so I can talk about my favorite tastings. The food that is the everlasting. See, I'm not fasting, I'm gobbling like a doggone turkey. Beef jerky, Slim Jims, I eat sometimes. I like lemon and limes, and if not that, I get the roti and the sour sauce. Sit back, relax, listen to some hip hop.
Drops of gummy bears tease my eyes. A sight for sore ones and so up highs. And other goodies that are filled with glue. With pineapple roots, delectable delights, controls my appetites. Boss is more e-right, but I know what I like. Chicken for lunch, chicken for my dinner. Chicken, 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 I'm a finger-licking winner. When breakfast time comes, I don't recognize. Pig in the pan or a pair of broken shies. Pizza, stewed tomatoes, home-fried potatoes, or anything with flair. Cook it, I'm in there. Pay attention to the tribe as we impose. This is how it goes.
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause I'm high in cholesterol.
I don't eat no ham and eggs,
don't fight. Do you eat them? Not at all.
Come on, get it, girl.
I don't eat no ham and eggs, cause I'm high in cholesterol.
Yo, do you eat them?
No shot, do you eat them?
Nope,
not at all.
Can I get it on champ before I go? I can get it on champ? All right. I want the right half to get funky, to say funk. And the other half to say rhythm on a count of three. One, two, one, two, three. Kick it.
Funk, rhythm, funk,
funk, funk, funk, rhythm, funk. Funk, rhythm, funk, 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 rhythm, funk, rhythm, funk, yeah, go, 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 work it out, here we go, keep it rolling, work it out, work it out, work it out, work it out, work booty, work it out.
What y'all know about that right there? What y'all know about that? Yeah, I always tried to convince myself I would not be that dude. That old dude talking about my music in my time. But it's hard. It's a curse that's hard to avoid. What you know about that right there? Boy, that right there, that's real music right there. Y'all know about that. You know, I'm that dude. Somebody got to be that dude. Somebody was that dude for us, right? Somebody provided that vital skill, telling us about music that came before us, how we don't know anything about it, and how it was so much better than whatever we listen to today. Somebody has to provide that vital service to young people. So, I guess I have even involuntarily become that dude. But y'all know about that right there, that music, boy. Anyway, Native Tongues. The Native Tongues. Tribe Called Quest, Ham and Eggs. Before that was Stakes Is High. Off of the Stakes Is High album, De La Soul. I mean, did I even have to say it? Did I even have to tell y'all who that was and what that was about? I don't think I should have had to. Anyway, Bro Diallo Show. You can call in. 312-985-7834. Now, as I was saying, we have a lot of unskilled, unprepared, irrational people within our cipher. And I think the Black liberation struggle, the conscious community, African-centered community, we spend a lot of time jawboning about everybody outside the struggle and don't spend enough time on critical analysis, critical review, and auditing those inside the struggle. We figure once you're in the struggle, then you're obviously conscious. You're obviously one of the best people. And I think that about the conscious people who make the commitment to take that baton from our ancestors, take the baton from Ida B. Wells, take the baton from Harriet Tubman, take the baton from Amos Wilson, take the baton from all those who came before us of Black empowerment, Black liberation, opposition to oppression. I think you are the best people. Not more human, not more worthy, but you are the best people, the people that I cherish the most, more than anybody else. And if you went to a Christian church, then everybody in that cipher, everybody in that huddle would be like, Christian, we are the best. We are that beacon of light on the hill. Or else why would you be doing it if you didn't think that was the best? If you were with even the gangbangers, even the hood cats, like, yo, nobody better than us. Listen to their music, street music, thug music, gang music, whatever. Everybody think what they're doing is the best thing for them to be doing and would probably recommend it to others. Otherwise, you know, unless you're dealing with somebody that's like struggling with addiction, they tend to be more honest. Drinkers and injectors, sniffers, smokers, they'll be like, don't be like me. I wish I wasn't like this. But generally, outside of certain classification, most people think they're the best. And I think I greatly value the conscious, revolutionary, progressive, activists, even like the true progressives. I can't mess with liberals. I think liberals are as bad as everybody. I think liberals are a blight on our communities and our struggles. But you take a step beyond liberalism into true progressivism. Everybody from progressive on further left of the spectrum, I value you greatly. And that's why it pains me to see so little value given to the struggle, since I value the people within the struggle. And I think people don't value the struggle because there's no official standing. You like I said, anything else you want to be in the hood, no matter what it is, even if you say, I want to be a gangster, I want to be in the military, I want to be a corporal in the Marines. I don't know. Almost anything that a young person or even an adult can aspire to be, there's a system. And one of the best things about it, and what we know and why we value certain people in certain positions, we know that the work they put in to get there. You can look at them and say, hey, I know this dude to be playing basketball on this here television had to put in a lot of work, you know, to be this professional or that, even to be a mechanic. You can look at them and say, hey, I know that even a bus driver or a big rig semi driver, even the blue collar workers, there's a certain level of skill. And even if it's not a very technical job, you know doggone well they got to get up early in the morning. And it's backbreaking and it's hard work. And you know they do it. And you know they out there doing it for the family, doing what they got to do. You know, working at the park and recreation service. So that's what gives us a certain level of value of the hard American worker. Plus all the working class propaganda of workers being hard and moral and people that don't work being bad, as opposed to people who the economy deliberately takes out of the job market to sustain profits. But when you look at a revolutionary, you can't look at a black conscious person and be like, you know, that person's been tried and tested. You know, that person has been put through the ringer. You know that his peers have held him to a higher standard than the rest of us. You can't say that because they don't. I know whole communities, if not whole movements and entire organizations where people just reinforce each other's BS. You know, that you actually know somebody who, and we all do, that when they woke up, when they became conscious, their lives, their attitudes, their dispositions deteriorated. They became people that you don't want anything to do with. You hate to see them coming. Because, you know, they come in with some nonsense and they're going to bring you down. And it's just not a person you're even motivated to deal with. And it's not just, and they will tell you, oh, you just saying you don't want to hear the truth. It ain't the truth that their people don't want to hear. It's you particular. Because we don't cultivate our revolutionaries. We say, because, and again, we're such a small minority. There's so few of us who take this on that, you know, and when you become a minority, like any other minority, you start to feel a certain level of persecution. And then persecution does come down on you. And whenever you're persecuted, there's a constructive way to deal with it and there's a destructive way to deal with it. And it's a nightmare. You hear somebody in your family then got with the sovereign citizen movement and got with the Hebrews. I ain't no Christian. That's a slave name. I'm a Muslim. I'm like, oh, gosh. Oh, your eyes just roll in the back of your head because you know what's coming. You know what's coming. A lot of nonsense and dysfunction. Now, not everybody that goes on those various routes, but even I'm a Zulu, bring down the system. You know, and you know what's coming. A lot of dysfunction, a lot of unnecessary hardship, a lot of hostility and judgment without anything on the other side of it. I'm not anti-hostility. I'm not anti-judgment. Justin, I am anti-dysfunction. So if whatever judgment you're passing down, you're supposed to make, like when you're crossing the street and you see oncoming traffic and you make the judgment, say, hey, I'll stay back and wait. I'll take a few extra moments. That's a proper judgment that's beneficial. Even it might be a negative judgment. If I step off this curve, I'm going to get hit by a car. Oh, that's so negative. You're thinking negative. You've got a lot, you know, that's such a negative thought. Such a depressing thought that you might get run over by a bus. And then you make a judgment based on that negative thought saying that I'm not going to enter traffic until the traffic clears up. Yeah, and I know, and you think, oh, why are you saying such simplistic stuff? Because it seems to me that our people don't understand this at the most fundamental levels. So, when you make a judgment, even if it's negative, African people are under a campaign of genocide. Systematic, well-funded, deliberate genocide. And all of these things we see, drug addiction, mass incarceration, under resources, deteriorating schools, are all part of that genocide. That's not only a judgment, that is a very negative, depressing judgment. And so just like if you look down the street and say, that bus is coming, and it could hit me and kill me. So what do I do based on that judgment? I'm going to run across the street as fast as I can, as opposed to standing here and letting the bus go past. So you run out in front of the bus and you make a judgment, and then your actions, because a judgment is a psychological thing. It's an intellectual thing. And then you have to carry out the sentence. I know I'm kicking the hell out of these analogies. So you make this judgment that your people under genocide. So what do you do? Do you run out in traffic? Do you hang back? Do you maybe try to signal the bus from the safety of the curve to slow down? There's a lot of options for you. But a lot of times our people who come to this accurate, although negative judgment, have some of the most dysfunctional reactions. You have black people starting to say, well, I'm going to become this militant freedom fighter, but I'm going to alienate almost every segment of the community. And I know people are rolling their eyes. What do you mean alienate? You're the one talking about Jesus and this, and you always dissing what people believe. And that may be true. But you find those same people. There's a lot of people that when it comes to the work versus the dialogue versus the discourse versus the debate, when it comes to the work, you know, that's something that anyone will tell you that has ever worked with me. When it comes to that, you know, that's the time when the discourse and the debate are shelved and the only discussion left is how do we most effectively execute this task? What resources do we need? How do we go about securing these resources? And how soon can we complete this task? And any problems or obstacles encountered by the task, how do we overcome those obstacles? And after the task is complete, before we move on to the next task, we evaluate. How was it done? How do we do it better? How do we avoid the obstacles or better engage the obstacles coming forward? Very rational process. But then when it's time to take off your hard hat, to take off the tie and get back to your life or whatever, civilian work, then you can have whatever discussions you want. But we got people bringing petty conflicts into necessary work. So I really do think, and I'm going to work on a skills assessment. We really should have a curriculum. Some organizations do. The Panthers were really onto something when they say the first thing you do when you join the Panthers is if you have a reading list. There should be certain fundamental skills. If you want to claim I'm a revolutionary, and whether you think the revolution is going to be, you know, an administrative thing, a bureaucratic process, where we develop some policies, you know, we put the right people in place, we get some competent bureaucrats and administrators over our organizations and into governing bodies. Whether you think the revolution is about educating young people, whether you think the revolution is about empowering black women, mothers, and reproductive rights, becoming a doula or a midwife and getting our sisters, whatever you think, there's certain universal skills, certain universal understandings and certain universal methods that should go. If you are a revolutionary, somebody should be able to look at you no matter how you choose to engage the struggle. Whether you say, hey, I'm going to be engaged to struggle through art, with my art, there should be certain a fundamental basis that anybody says, like, just like it's a physician, a professor, an athlete, a plumber, a social worker. There's certain fundamental, and there's other, you could be a social worker working from, you know, with abandoned children or working with adult drug addicts. But there's certain fundamental baseline, your undergrad, before you go into your specialty. No matter what the physician is, whether you're a gynecologist or a podiatrist, there's certain fundamental levels of understanding you have to have. So we do need a conscious curriculum. We need a curriculum that says, well, you know, I was just talking to a young scholar, and he said when he engages people, if there's certain understanding, certain books a person had, he hadn't read certain arenas of study or scholarship, if the person is unfamiliar with, he's like, I'm not going to waste time. You have some people say, I'm conscious, I'm a revolutionary, and I just read the Bible. You know, a lot of our, you know, religious nationalists. And they think the Bible, if you don't understand the Bible, you don't know nothing. Now, and that's the problem. Or you have, I knew one guy, he was a revolutionary. He said, there's one book, Yerugal, read Yerugal. If you wanted to join his movement, if you wanted to be a member of his organization, you had to read, not only did you have to read Yerugal, you had to agree with everything written in Yerugal. Now, I love Yerugal. I had an opportunity to meet with Dr. Marimba Ani. She autographed my copy of Yerugal, and I have an autographed copy of Let the Circle Be Unbroken. Very familiar with her. Can't say I agree with, and like I said, probably maybe one or two scholars where I haven't read or seen anything, and I'm like, huh, I would have said that differently, or I don't see it that way. It's healthy. So it ain't just read this book and graft everything in this book onto your own understanding without questioning. So everybody should not just read these texts, certain texts. They should have a critical analysis of the text. So one thing you really need is the ability to do research and critical analysis. And it should be engaged in. And when we had the African race, we had a study group. And every week that the study group met, there would be one person who would have to lead the group that's within the group. So they wouldn't just have to read the materials for the following week. They would have to come up with an analysis and interpretation and present their findings to the group. And then they would lead the discussion and moderate the discussion. Because everybody needs those type of skills. Because you'll have study groups, you'll notice some people just kind of chill in the cut. They might or might not have done the reading. And they chill in the cut. But this is something that, so everybody. And I think this is a thing that we understand that in our organizations, through COINTELPRO and other insidious means, they always come in our movements, whether it's a national movement or a local organization, whether it's in the African diaspora or on the African continent, they always come with the decapitation. You take out the spokesperson. You take out the charismatic leader. You take out the prophet, you know, and the whole movement just scatters. So with a certain method, everybody, if you have an organization and someone says, well, we want someone from your organization to speak, you don't send out the same person every time. I don't really like the official spokesperson type thing. I think anyone, no matter what their role in the organization, should be at a level where they can not just interpret or articulate the mission of the organization, but have a certain baseline of study. You don't allow someone to be a member of your organization. They're around for a decade and they're languishing, not knowing anything more than when they join, besides they just want to do something positive. And in any organization, no matter how supposedly revolutionary or conscious, you have the clique. You have I was a member of an organization that had individuals who were engineers, had PhDs in economics, you know, that were scholars, property owners, business owners. And then you had rank and file people that didn't have high school diplomas in the same organization because they wanted to better the community. They wanted to contribute to the community. And cliques would form where the more affluent members of the organization would kind of sit with, literally, like when we'd have meetings or we'd have group actions. And when members of the organizations would maybe form personal friendships and have dinner parties. And the more affluent members, the better educated members of the organization would hang out with the other ones, go golfing together while the poorer members. And that weakened the organization overall. And I don't even think it was deliberate. I don't even hold it against. And I can't even say I wasn't participating in it. But we have to work to eliminate that. We can't have a caste system or a class hostilities within a revolutionary organization. And one way to eliminate that is to bring everyone in the organization to have a certain tone and standard for academic and intellectual development. And those who don't know, make it their obligation to teach those who know, teach those who each one teach one. Each one teach one. So no one should tolerate. And here's another thing. if you want to be a revolutionary, if you want to be a member of the organization, then you can't be one of those, I ain't with all that reading, I'm here for action. That person, then you have to go find an action organization. Because this is a revolutionary organization. And we understand that you need as much studies. It's like I tell all these brothers who want to be gun-toting, you know, have this romantic view of that we're just going, there's going to be this grand uprising, armed insurgency. It ain't going down like that. Nothing in the history or the current climate really demonstrates that. Not even Trump election. I'm sorry. So, if you want that, if you think that's where it's headed and you don't want to listen to the analysis, if you want to ignore the historical record, then go find an action organization. And then if you're a person who says, listen, I know revolution is action and intellect. It's the mind and body. And I tell these militants, when you go join the military, the biggest and only truly global military empire in the history of existence, the U.S. military, you spend as much time in the classroom as you do on the range. You cannot find one established military base in the world that doesn't have classrooms. The Pentagon is full of offices and classrooms and libraries. Right downtown, you have the Pritzker Military Library. I'm planning on going to Kansas City in a few weeks. They got the World War II Memorial Museum and Research Library. And you will not find a general in the U.S. military who is not a scholar. In order to become a 1-star, 2-, 3-, 4-star general, you have to publish in peer-reviewed academic journals. It's a scholarly position. You don't become a general because you were the best fighter. That's a big part of it. You definitely have to pay your dues on that front. But you can maybe become maybe a corporal. You know, you're just a bloodthirsty, you know, adrenaline junkie. There's a place for you, but it's not at the leadership. It's not at the helm. And even then, if you're an adrenaline junkie, you still got to get past that entrance exam and other competency tests. So people who are all about that action, I tend to find that they're just not. And they have a really short lifespan within the larger struggle. They burn out pretty fast. So you should let it be known that if you're an organization or an individual working on something, that this is not about all that action, and we're not about all that talk. But we are about analysis and research and being academically and scientifically grounded. And it should be the tone, if nothing else, no matter what a person's ideological slant is. If you encounter someone who is African-centered, if you go to a Kwanzaa organization, a Kwanzaa event at the end of the year, a Moja Karamu, if you go to an African festival, if you go to an organizational gathering, a speech or anything, people from the outside our community, from outside our movement should be like, if I don't know nothing else about these crazy black folks with their crazy dreadlocks and their crazy African garb and, you know, their crazy Hotep, Alafia, Salam greetings within their funny looking vegan or African foo-foo food. If I don't know nothing else about these people, I know they are a well-studied and well-researched people. They're not going to come at you with what they believe. And even if they're telling you something that is foreign to you or sounds absurd or obscene to you, you can know this. It's something that they can refer, give you some references. They can help you to guide in your own study because they are not telling you anything that they have not thoroughly sussed out, researched, and dissected and reconstructed again and again. And they're even though it's something they truly believe and that they've researched, they're still open for any critical, intelligent criticism or inputs. That should be the background standard. That alone is a recruitment tool. That alone will give us better standing and legitimacy. That alone would dispel a lot of this Hotep disrespect that our movement is dealing with. And negative, both propaganda, deserved and unearned. Another thing we really need, a skill that we need, is discourse. We need to know how to talk to people. I had my dear brother, Skip Kuhn. on the show, and someone commented that I felt as a compliment. He's like, I've never seen two people who disagree so much have such a respectful conversation. You know, and that's why I try to avoid bringing people on the show that I know get off on that whole, I'm melanated, bitch. You know, I don't want them kind of people on the show because it's really just a spectacle. And I can do spectacle on my own. I can do bad all by myself. I don't need to bring somebody on to do bad. I try to bring people on that I know at least have the ability to discourse. If it goes off the rails, then so be it. That has happened in previous shows. You know, check the archives. But if it goes off the rails, then so be it. But even people, I've had another, you know, sister that we don't, besides the fact that we want our people to be free, we don't agree on much else, on how to get us there. We don't, you know, but I had on the show, and it was a very enriching dialogue for me. And so you got to know how to engage in resource. You got to know how to not take things personal, how to avoid, you know, inappropriate anger or even emotionalism in the inappropriate time. And I'm not saying we got to be robotic, because it's times like where we can cuss and spit and even throw hands. There's a time for all that. And there's a time for that stuff to be shelved because you're trying to get somewhere. And even if there's a dispute, you understand that just people who disagree with you are not inherently your enemy. And they're not always wrong. So, you know, that we should teach the art of discourse and constructive engagement of people who have divergent ideas and understandings in us. That's another skill. And conflict, internal conflict resolution. For within the organization, you got people within, there's so many organizations that have a lot of festering issues. I've never become, you know, I'm now working on building my own organization with my allies from the ground up. But prior to that, I would always work with existing organizations. I always had the position of why reinvent the wheel, and you just join an organization. If you don't like what you see there, then you exercise organizational discipline and you try to work and improve from within. All that. But one thing I would always find in any existing organization that there's always festering conflicts that people just try to overshadow in the name of unity instead of putting it out there. There's a lot of issues people have. I mean, you'd literally go to a meeting and you discuss the agenda, what the plans are. If you were part of a committee or a group or a project, you give a report like, oh, this is where we are and we need this and we're trying to raise these funds. And then it's like, okay, meeting adjourned. And depending on which way you go in that meeting, you're going to walk into a huddle of people. Yeah, and this, that. And they don't like the leader. And the leader's doing this and this, and that. And there's no opportunity to officially and constructively air out grievances or to put aside conflicts. We need to take our movement seriously. And we literally, in that organization that I'm referring to in particular, one of them, they literally had people who were trained in conflict resolution and worked for the local government in their mediation office and did not even give the benefit to their own organization to do that. You know? Anyway, more on this. It's Wednesday. Again, I apologize, and I'm going to do everything within my power to make sure it doesn't happen again, even rain, sleet, or snow, because I appreciate your support. I appreciate every set of ears and every set of eyes that are trained on the show, and I want to not waste people's time and give them, you know, quality insight. So, please, support where you can. And thanks for listening. This is Bro Diallo Show, broadcasting out of Chicago. I see y'all Wednesday morning.